gives it just gives an incredible amount of hope and encouragement. So it's from page 124. It's in the chapter The Family Afterwards, and it starts, Henry Ford once made a wise remark, and it's the that paragraph and the paragraph afterwards. So would somebody like to read that for us, please? Sophie, thank you.
Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problems. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that, in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them.
Thank you, Sophie. So yeah, if anybody is having a real wobble about step four, I think just remembering that, cling to the thought that in God's hands, my dark past is the greatest possession I have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, I can avert death and misery for them. I think is just a really great reminder of the power of step four and step five. Okay, so obviously, in addiction, we talk about alcoholism and we talk about the disease of compulsive overeating. But I was told that the ism on the end of alcoholism is the thing that we all have as addicts, whatever our substances or our addictive behavior, because the ism stands for I see me. And that is the selfishness that's described in the big book, selfishness that's the root of all my problems. And what step four is going to do, it's going to highlight the ism. So when I'm in active disease, I can see only me. I can only see I'm the victim and you're the problem. But in recovery, I get to see me. So I see that the me in self is the problem. But with my higher power's help, I can change. So step four helps me to highlight and see what the problem is. And we're given a time frame for step four. So once we've done step three, we're told that the time frame for step four is next. We don't delay. So we don't sit for 6 months after we've taken step three. We start our step four immediately. And that step four is like the first action step because steps one, two, and three have just been kind of conclusions of our mind. We've been presented with the evidence, we've had a mirror held up to us, and we have concluded that we are compulsive overeaters, our lives are unmanageable, only a power can help us that's greater than us, and we're going to hand our life over to that power. So step four is the first time we're going to actually physically do something. And we're also told that although our step three decision is a vital and crucial step, it's not going to give us any permanent effect, i.e., freedom from food obsession, unless it's followed at once by action to get rid of the things that are blocking us from the power. And we understand that because we've seen so far that lack of power is our problem. So the way that we're going to get connected to that power starts in step four. And we're told that our overeating is just a symptom. We have to understand the causes for our overeating. And this is what step four is going to show us. And I often remind sponsees, and I had to be reminded about this a lot, that it's not an overly emotional process. Yes, it can be challenging to do what we have to do in step four, but if we can remind ourselves that it's about looking for facts and facing those facts. And step four uncovers the reasons why we overeat. And we're looking at how self shows up in our lives. So the areas that we look at in step four, and I've not gone into lots and lots of detail about step four and step five, because my experience is you really have to be led through this by a sponsor. But just some of the principles around step four and step five. We're going to look at resentments. And I was told that's when I can't stop thinking about you and what you've done to me. We're going to look at selfishness when I can't stop thinking about me. We're going to look at my dishonesty when I can't stop thinking. So I make stories up, I exaggerate for effect. And we're going to look at fear, which is when I cannot stop thinking about me with you, what you think of me, what if you don't do what I need and want you to do. So of them all, we're told that resentment is the number one offender, and we see that on page 64. And again, the big book uses really, really strong language here. It says resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more compulsive overeaters than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we have not been only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. And when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So, as addicts, we cannot afford to carry resentments because they block us from our higher power. And I don't know, again, if you've had this experience, but I have literally lost days upon days of my life by being absolutely consumed with a resentment. What somebody's said to me, what somebody's done to me, how dare they do that? This is what I should have said. This is what I'm going to do to get even. I mean, literally, I have just been totally consumed for days on ends with thoughts like that. So if I'm consumed by those thoughts, then I am going to be blocked from my power. And I've already been told that I'm powerless. So then I'm in trouble. This is going to destroy us. And that's why the big book uses such strong language. And it says when we heal spiritually, remember we've got a spiritual disease, we're going to straighten out mentally and physically. And there's a reminder on page 117. It says, never forget that resentment is a deadly hazard to a compulsive overeater. And that's because we block ourselves off from our higher power. And then on page 66, it says, it is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But with Gail, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal because when Gail is harboring such feelings, she shuts herself off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of compulsive overeating returns and she binges again. And with Gail, to binge is to die. If Gail's going to live, she has to be free of anger. The grouch, the slow burn anger, and the brainstorm, the rage, is not for Gail. They may be the dubious luxury of normal people, but for Gail, these things are poison. So again, I'm told that having resentments is going to get in the way of me and my higher power. Because I'm going to be completely shut off. And then when the food thoughts come, and I'm told they will, and I never know when that is, then I'll pick up and I'm back in a cycle that is going to kill me. And of course, if I'm feeling uncomfortable and I don't like how I'm feeling, then my brain is going to go, oh, Gail, we know what makes you feel better. You need to go and eat X, Y, and Z or indulge in this behavior and you'll feel better. And that's never, ever going to work. So when we're doing step four, we look at who or what we're resentful at. And I was told, just write anything down that is just occupying space in your head. Things that you complain to people about, we know the stuff that we're irritated about. And then I'm going to look at which part of self is affected. And basically, in the second column, when I'm looking at the cause of my resentment, I'm basically taking the person's inventory that's affected me. I'm saying, this is what this person's done to irritate me or to feel like this. And then in column three, I'm really looking at my ego, what I believe to be true, how I believe things should be, what I believe I need and how I think you need to behave to give me what I need. And there's some really good definitions of the various aspects of self. So self-esteem, who I believe I am, security, what I think I need, ambition, how I want my life or things to be, relationships, how I think you should behave and treat me, and then sex relationships as above, so how I think you should behave, be and treat me, but when my sex instinct is active. So through the step four process, I start to see that people on my resentment list were sick just like me. They behave in ways that upset me, but I've often done the same behavior. And I ask my higher power for help in seeing them this way. And I need to remember that people who irritate me aren't doing it deliberately. They have no choice because they're just acting out of self. You know, they are in self just like I can be, but they don't have a process like I have to help them. And I'm just irritated because I want something different to what I'm getting. And I also see how I have a tendency to deny my part and over-exaggerate the part of others. And that's what step four started to show me. And then on page 67, sorry, I just have to go into the bit of my big book that's not falling to bits. On page 67, it says that we ask God for help in showing other people the same tolerance, pity and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And when a person offends us, we say to ourselves, this is a sick person. How can we be helpful to them? God save me from being angry. Thy will be done. So that's known as the sick person's prayer. And this helps me to move into column four, which asks me to look at where have I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking and frightened, because that's how I behave when I'm in self-will. And I'm told that I go back to my list because it holds the key to my future. And I can see the power that others hold over me. So that example that I gave you when I lost, you know, 3 or 4 days was how a team at work behaved towards me. And I was absolutely raging that it was really unfair what they'd said about me. You know, that wasn't right. And I was going to do this and they shouldn't have done that. They had the power over me because they completely controlled my thinking for 3 or 4 days. But I can't change others. I can't change what that team thought about me or how that team reacted to me. I can only look at myself. And I'm also told that I cannot free myself of the resentments on my own power, just like I couldn't put the food down. I've got to have my higher power by my side and be guided by a sponsor throughout this whole process. So next, the big book moves on to looking at fear, and it asks us to complete a fear inventory. And it describes fear as an evil and corroding thread. It talks about the fabric of our existence being shot through with it. And again, we see that fear comes from self-reliance. And I know that self-reliance is always going to fail me. And when I'm fearful, it's usually because I'm fearful of not getting my own way. I'm not going to get what I think I need to be okay. I'm going to lose something that I've got that I think I need to have to be okay. And of the consequences of one of my actions or of getting found out. And when I'm in fear, I distort the truth. And remember on page 62, I'm told that I am driven by 100 forms of fear. You know, that's absolutely huge. And we're told that perhaps there's a better way. And again, there's a really great practical example of this in one of the stories at the back of the big book, aptly named The Man Who Mastered Fear. And it's on page 255. And if somebody would like to read that for us, it starts with the paragraph, "So much for my business life." It's about 3/4 of the way down the page. And it goes over to the next page, 256, and stops halfway down with the paragraph that ends, "I have a swell time." So would somebody like to read this example for us? Thanks, Eileen.
Thank you. Start with "So much for my business life, Gail."
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. So much for my business life. Obviously, I have overcome fear to a sufficient degree to think in terms of success in business. With God's help, I am able for one day at a time to carry business responsibilities that not many years ago I would not have dreamed of assuming. But what about my social life? What about those fears that once paralyzed me to the point of my becoming a semi-hermit? What about my fear of travel? Do I continue?
Yes, please.
It would be wonderful were I able to tell you that my confidence in God and my application of the 12 steps to my daily living have utterly banished fear. But this would not be the truth. The most accurate answer I can give you is this: fear has never again ruled my life since that day in September 1938 when I found that a power greater than myself could not only restore me to sanity, but could keep me both sober and sane. Never in 16 years have I dodged anything because I was afraid of it. I have faced life instead of running away from it. Some of the things that used to stop me in my tracks from fear still make me nervous in the anticipation of their doing. But once I kick myself into doing them, nervousness disappears and I enjoy myself. In recent years, I have had the happy combination of time and money to travel occasionally. I am apt to get into quite an uproar for a day or two before starting, but I do start, and once started, I have a swell time.
Thanks, Eileen. Thank you so much. That's great. So yeah, I think that just again is a just a lovely practical example of what we've been talking about. It doesn't necessarily say that I'm going to have a life that is free of fear, but I've got a process for dealing with that fear when it comes up. So on page 68, again, we're reminded that, you know, the reason that we have fear is because the basis of trusting and relying upon God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. We have to remember our step three decision and commitment. So every fear that I have had has always been because I'm relying on myself. I'm not relying on my higher power. And again, on page 68, we're reminded that we let God demonstrate through us what he can do. You know, I am one of God's workers, and my higher power is going to show me a wonderful life. The miracles of recovery will be abundant. Even in challenging times, my higher power will get me through. I just show up every day, and God works through me. And then we also have the fear prayer, where we let God demonstrate through us what he can do. And this is the fear prayer. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what God would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. And we can say that prayer anytime that we are fearful. And again, it recognizes that we cannot get rid of fear on our own power. And if I didn't have this fear, how would I be? So if I wasn't fearful about something that was going to potentially happen to my children, to one of my children, what would I be like? How would I be? And again, you know, linked to step three, I have no need to fear. I have given myself to the care of my higher power. And then finally, the big book moves on to the last part of step four, which is the sex inventory. And this is not about who we've had sex with, what we've done. It's about who we have harmed when our sex instinct has been active. So it's about relationships. And it talks about there are many different views on sex, and we all have problems in this area. But the big book makes it clear for us not to judge anyone else's behavior in this area. And again, I think when we share that with a sponsee, it really helps in step five because we're not there to judge what somebody else has done. And we answer the questions listed in the second paragraph on page 69. And then we then use this information to shape our future sex life. You know, what is it that I want to bring to future relationships that improves on my past mistakes and will make this relationship better? How would I want to be treated in a relationship? And although this part of the big book focuses on sex, I was told that the guidance in this section can be used in any situation, in any part of my life. And we don't only look at our sex ideals, we look at the ideals for any of the roles that we play in our lives. So, you know, a wife, a daughter, a mum, a friend, a sponsor. So what I did was I took some time, and in each of those roles, what would God want me to be? So something that was kind of particularly important for me is that my parents are pretty amazing. They're 84 and 87, but they are aging. And I can sometimes feel a bit impatient with them when they might be a little bit slow in grasping. I just had an insane conversation with my mum earlier about WhatsApp. And I have to remind myself to be patient with my mum and dad because, when I'm 84 or 87, I'm probably not going to be as sharp as I am today. So I've got one of the characteristics for me as a daughter is that I want to be patient, loving, and tolerant with my mum and dad. But I can't do that. I've got to ask God to mold those ideals and then help me to live up to them. And so a practical example of that for me would be before I see my mum and dad, I just say a quick prayer and ask for help to be patient, loving, and tolerant, because on my own, I can't do that. And I'm probably going to be a bit kind of short when I'm talking to them because I'm a bit irritated that I'm having to explain something three times. And the book also recognizes that this is not going to happen overnight. It says I must be willing to grow towards it with God's help. And I ask for God's help. There's a lovely sentence on page 69, and it says, in meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. And in the big book at that point, it's talking about sex, but we can apply that to absolutely anything. And it says the right answer will come if we want it. And then it recognizes that we are only human and we are going to fall short of our ideals as we often do. So, although I might be praying for patience and tolerance with my mum and dad, sometimes I end up being a little bit abrupt in one of my responses. So, what happens then? It says, what happens if I fall short of my ideal? As I often do, am I going to end up back in the food? And I'm told that if I'm generally sorry, genuinely sorry for what I've done, I've got the honest desire to let God change me, then I will be forgiven and will have learned my lesson. If I'm not sorry and I continue to harm others regardless, then I will probably end up back in the food. That's what it tells us on page 70. And again, on page 70, it says to sum up about sex. And again, it's talking about sex, but we can apply this guidance to any situation. It's really helpful guidance. It tells us the first thing we need to do is we earnestly pray for the right ideal. The second thing is we ask for guidance in each questionable situation. The third thing we do is ask for sanity. And the fourth thing we do is ask for the strength to do the right things. And that is guidance that serves me well in every single area of my life. And then it also tells us that if I'm still struggling, then I need to throw myself harder into helping others, which takes me out of myself. And then on page 70, there's a paragraph that starts, if we have been thorough. And I was told that that is the step four checklist. So once I've finished my step four, can I tick all of those requirements? Have I been thorough in the task that has been presented to me? And I'm also reminded that faith will do for me what I cannot do, and that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked me off from him. And remember the description of what I'm like in self at step three. And I was also told, it doesn't explicitly say this in the big book, but I was also told to do a final inventory using the sex inventory guidance on people that I had harmed, but without the sex instinct. And again, that was very, very useful when I came to steps 8 and 9 because it enabled me to look at people that I had harmed when the sex instinct hadn't been activated. So the big book gives very clear instructions on undertaking step four. So I guess we could do a step four on our own because the instructions are really, really clear. But my experience was that I needed to work with a sponsor to guide me through the process and support me through the process. The how is not really important. There are many, many different forms to use. People have particular ways in which they like doing step fours. What matters is actually doing it and making sure that we have covered what the big book is asking us to do. It doesn't have to be a perfect piece of work. I've worked with some sponsees who've been kind of pretty paralyzed around step four because they think it's a one and done piece of work. It has to be perfect. It's basically just where you are today and you are doing a step four to the best of your ability. You're going to be living the rest of your life in steps 10 and 11, and you may well do many more step fours. So we just need to complete step four to the best of our ability at the time. And if something needs to come up and it's not come up in your step four, my experience is it will come up at some point. So I'm not going to ask you to do the questions on step four because they're very simple, and you know they're just asking, are you willing to do a step four to the best of your ability? If you've already done a step four, have you done a thorough inventory? And are you willing to seek guidance from your sponsor on doing step four? So they're very, very simple questions. So in the interest of time, I'm not going to ask you to do those questions. Okay, so moving into chapter six, into action, and let's just have a look at step five. And again, I've kept this relatively brief because my experience is that you need guidance from a sponsor to do this. So step five, admitted to God, to ourselves and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrong. And the spiritual principle is integrity. So on page 72, it asks the question, having made our personal inventory, then what shall we do about it? So in this paragraph, we're reminded of step two, that we've been trying to get a new attitude. We're reminded of step three, about a new relationship with our creator. And we're reminded of step four, discovering the obstacles in our path, admitting certain defects, and we've ascertained what our trouble really is. And we've identified the weak items in our inventory, but we're told that that's not enough. We have to go further. We have to admit to God, to ourselves and to another human being, the exact nature of our defects. And that brings us on to step five. And this step starts the disconnection process from our ego. And I'm told that if I do not do this step, then I may not overcome compulsive overeating. And we're told time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives, trying to avoid this humbling experience. They have turned to easier methods and almost invariably they got drunk or compulsively overate again. And on page 73, we're told that we must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long or happily in this world. And I'm told that I'm engaged on a life and death errand, recognizing how critical my step five is to my recovery. And again, not everybody will choose to do step five with their sponsor. My experience is that if I have got somebody through the steps up to this point, they usually want me to hear their inventory. I've never had somebody say, I'm going to go and share this with somebody else. But that is perfectly acceptable if people want to do that. And we're told that we need to pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. And, you know, I had a real deep sense of shame about some of the stuff on my step four. And I can remember the very first time I did it, being at my sponsor's house and asking her if I could go and sit in the next room while I did certain parts of my step four so I didn't have to look at her because I was really embarrassed. And I actually spent most of the time behind my book like that. And you know what? She's still in my life today. She's an absolutely wonderful person. She thinks I'm a wonderful person. She didn't run for the hills at some of the stuff I've done. And most times when I hear a step five, I have been in very similar situations and done very similar things to sponsees. There's a real sense of identification. And I think step five impacts positively in so many areas of our life and recovery because it really helps us to connect on a deeper level with another individual. You know, I'd certainly isolated myself from others as a compulsive overeater, and I started to free myself of the shame because I've shared everything about myself with another person and they still love and accept me. And as I said, you know, I've often shared some similarities with others from my own step five. So we see that we're not alone in the things that we've done. And we also see the futility of blaming others for our problems. And importantly, we see that we're not bad people. You know, I saw that most of what was behind my behavior was fear, not trusting that my basic needs will be met. And therefore, I was fighting for survival in the only way I know. And forgiving and accepting myself was a really key component of step five. And that helped me to forgive and accept other people. It was the start of learning to love myself, and that is still very much an ongoing journey. And one of the reasons that I overate because I hated myself and I had such a deep sense of shame about who I was. And in looking at the exact nature of my wrongs, not just the headlines, I see what it is in my nature that causes me to react to life the way I do. And it's an amazing example, step five, of being honest. And I see how to be honest, which is not my natural state. And I also remember that I've got many positive traits as well. And that is relevant in step seven, because in step seven, I offer my whole self to my higher power. I offer myself, my good, my bad, whatever is going on. And we're told that once we've taken a thorough step five, we receive the step five promises, which are outlined on page 75. I'm told that I can look the world in the eye. I can be alone at perfect peace and ease. My fears are going to fall from me. I start to feel the nearness of my higher power. I might have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now I begin to have a certain spiritual experience. The feeling that the food problem has disappeared will often come on strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. So step five might be really, really tough, but actually that's what's on the other side of it. And I think that is just absolutely beautiful. So once we've shared everything with our sponsor, we've got one final task to do in relation to step five. And that is the instructions on the bottom of page 75. We go home. We or wherever we are, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, and we give thanks to our higher power, and we review our work so far. So we review the steps that we've got to so far. We check that we've put the foundation in place. We check that we've not missed anything out. We ask God to show us, and sometimes things come up that need to be on our step four and five, or sometimes things don't come up, and we just, we just carry on with the rest of the process. So again, there's a number of questions that are really helpful to consider when you're doing your step five. And my sponsor asked me to look at all of those. Particularly, was there anything that I had omitted from my inventory? She said to me, "Is there anything that you've not told me that you know you've not told me that you don't want to share with me? Is there anything that I want to keep secret forever?" So again, those are just a really helpful set of questions for when you do your step five, or if you've done a step five, can you answer yes to those questions? Okay, so that brings us on to step six and seven, which are the final two steps that we're going to look at today. So step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, and the spiritual principle that accompanies step six is willingness. So I've already seen evidence of how this step works in step one, because God has removed my food obsession. And this is where change really starts to happen. So just to recap where we've been, we've seen in step one, we see the problem. In step two, we see the solution. In step three, we make a decision. In step four, we identify the things that are blocking us from our higher power, and it shows us what needs changing in six and seven. And in step five, we re-examine the blocks, getting down to the exact nature when we share our step four with our sponsor. So if I can answer the questions at the end of page 75 with a yes, so that's are the foundations in place? Have we done the work thoroughly? Then we start to look at step six, and I'm asked two questions, two really simple questions. Am I now ready to let God remove from me all the things which I have admitted are objectionable? And the second question, can God now take them all, every one? So being entirely ready means that I am willing to turn my back on my old self-destructive behaviors and try to live by the principles outlined in the steps. Trying to practice new thinking and new behaviors to the best of my ability is what shows my true willingness to change. And I'm told that if I cling to something I will not let go of, I ask God to help me become willing. And at first glance, step six seems to be very easy, because who doesn't want our defects to go? However, my experience is that it isn't easy, because just like I got an effect from the food, I get an effect from my character defects. So, as an example, my anger, my temper meant that I usually got my own way because my family didn't want to upset me because they didn't want to be on the receiving end of a temper tantrum or an anger outburst. I got a thrill from gossiping. Criticizing others at work made me feel slightly superior for a period of time. So, letting go is not an easy thing to do. And there's a great vending machine analogy. So I heard a speaker talk about this, that they were talking about there was a little girl who'd got a hand stuck inside a vending machine, and her parents tried for ages to get a hand out. They were pulling, they was pushing her this way, pushing her that way, and they just literally could not get a hand out of this vending machine. So they had to send for the firefighters, who came along, and they were about to start sewing around in this machine so that they could get a hand out. And very quietly, this firefighter just bent down and he went over to this little girl and he said, "Have you got something in your hand?" And she said, Yes, I've got candy in my hand. It's my candy." And he said, Well, can you just let it go?" And she says, No, I'm not letting it go. It's mine. It's my candy." And he says, Just please, just let it go." Anyway, after about four attempts at asking her to let it go, he said, "If you let that go, I will get you some more candy, and I'll get you more candy than you've got in your hand." And the little girl let the candy go, and a hand just came out of the vending machine. And for me, that analogy around step six really, really works, because I didn't necessarily want to let go of those character defects because they were giving me an effect. I had really low self-esteem at work. So every time I criticized one of my colleagues, I felt a little bit superior, until I realized what awful behavior that was. And then I didn't feel superior at all. So I see that I need to change, but I can't do that alone. I need a power greater than me to make that happen. And remember, like with the food, my problem is lack of power. And I often remind sponsees that we're not bad people because we've got character defects. They're just a manifestation of my God-given instincts, which are there to keep me safe. I am not a bad person because I act out in certain ways. And step six is a growth step. So I am always going to be a work in progress. There isn't a point that I get to. I'm never going to be done. But God will do for me what I cannot. So I own my defects, and I'm willing, with God's help, to let them go. I stop struggling and I acknowledge I need help, and I can relax. I already have evidence that my higher power is doing for me what I cannot. Step six and seven are the steps where God reveals the true me. And I love this analogy. It's like the statue of David when Michelangelo was asked how he created such a masterpiece. And he said, "Well, David was there all along. I just chipped away at everything that wasn't David." And this is what my higher power does for me. God reveals the beautiful, authentic individual I am meant to be. This isn't to give me an easy life. This is about removing what blocks me from my usefulness to other people and God. And again, there's a lovely sentence on page 100 where it says, "You should point out that his defects of character are not going to disappear overnight." This is talking about family. Ask them to remember when they are impatient, the blessed fact of his sobriety. So I have to sometimes remind myself of the journey that I have been on and I'm still on, because I am not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. I regularly have to make amends, but I'm abstinent and I'm recovered. And when it comes to my character defects and my behavior, I am a work in progress. And I love this version of the serenity prayer. "God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to also do the things I can that will bring about the changes I can't." And that for me is the essence of step six and seven. I learn it's not possible for me on my own to get rid of my shortcomings and character defects. My higher power will do that for me. I don't work on my defects. I surrender them and they'll be removed in God's time. And God uses my defects and assets in many ways to accomplish his or her will. And God will do for me what I can't. Just as with the food, God will remove my food obsession, but I have to go and shop and prepare food. That is within my gift and my power. And God removes my defects, but I have to do my part. I've got to continue to do inventory. I've got to pray. I've got to be willing. I've got to pause. And I've got to try and practice the opposite of my defects. And I surrender to the spiritual process that neutralizes my character defects. I trade my defects for God's perfect traits, and it is very much in God's time. I use the example of pulling this big book study together when I did the Boston retreat. So it took me about 3 months to pull this big book study together. And one of my defects is perfectionism. And I believe that God used that defect of perfectionism to help me to produce this big book study, because I worked on it until it was good enough to be able to do a retreat for a full weekend. And so imagine my irritation when I spotted that I'd got something wrong in this that I didn't see when I did the Boston retreat, but I've seen it today. So that's just an example of how God can use our character defects to the good. And there's a story about the good wolf and the bad wolf that I'm sure you're familiar with. You know, a grandson asks his grandfather about the story of the good wolf and the bad wolf, and they talk about the characteristics of each wolf, and in the end, which wolf wins? And the grandfather says, the wolf that you feed. So that's me taking action to try and do those things that are going to help, but there's only God can remove my character defects. And the way that I identified my defects was I went through my step four, and under the following headings, resentments, fears, selfishness, dishonesty, and self-seeking, I listed all of those defects. And then my sponsor asked me to look at how has each of those defects worked for me, because there is a payoff in our defects usually. And how has each behavior and attitude caused me trouble? And am I willing to let God remove my defects? And am I willing to practice letting go of these shortcomings? So then finally, let's just round off in the last kind of few minutes that we've got left with step seven, which is humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. And the spiritual principle aligning this step is humility. And we've got this the seventh step prayer on page 76. And again, it doesn't matter the exact words that we say, but what we're saying is, you know, God, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. And that simple prayer completes step seven. And I was told that this is my second surrender, because my first surrender was at step three when I made that decision. This is where the change in my attitude happens, which enables me, with humility as my guide, to move out of myself towards others and towards God. We give our all to God, good and bad. I'm asking for my defects to be removed so that I can be of maximum use to God and to others, not to give me an easy life. And I'm asking for God's power to do God's work. And it's the same degree of humility that lets God's grace in to remove my food obsession. And I was also told that humility is not to be confused with humiliation. A good definition of humility is seeing myself for what I am and who I am. I'm right-sized. I'm on the middle ground between intense shame and thinking I'm God. And I want to be the best that I can be, my true self. And I have spent most of my life not being in this place. So I need to practice humility. It's not something that comes easily. And this involves willingness and surrender with an attitude of gratitude. And again, step seven is just a beginning. I have a lifetime's work ahead of me. I see the character defects that made me turn to food in the first place. And I understand that these must be dealt with to prevent a return to compulsive overeating. So some of the actions that helped me was working on acceptance of myself, you know, stopping that vicious circle of beating myself up if I did something wrong, losing the self-judgment, and practicing an attitude of gratitude and positivity. And if I practice an attitude of gratitude and positivity to other people, it makes it easier for me to accept and forgive other people when they mess up, like I mess up all of the time. And attitude is something that is really important to me because I can change my attitude. You know, if I wake up in a grump and I'm miserable and I'm in self-pity about something, I have the ability to choose a different attitude. And I can do that by making an outreach call, by getting interested in what somebody else is doing. I can change my attitude. And there's a fabulous little story in Drop the Rock. And I'll just read it. I've written it out here. And it says, Don D went to an AA meeting one evening. He frowned when a member mispronounced a few words while reading How It Works. He felt appalled when another member stood up and said he was an alcoholic and an addict. Another person talked too long. As he slipped out of the door immediately after the meeting, Don D muttered, "That was terrible. I should have stayed at home." Bob M went to a meeting one evening. His head was bowed as he listened to the preamble and How It Works. His eyes moistened as he listened intently to a member tell his story. He was grateful for being able to attend this meeting. After cleanup and a little socializing, he paused, and as he locked the meeting room door, his thoughts were, "Thank God for such a beautiful fellowship." Both AA members were at the same meeting. Each found what he was looking for. And I just love that story because it's just a reminder that I can change my attitude and I can choose to be positive and have an attitude of gratitude. So, what would God have me be? That's one of the questions for step seven. You know, what sort of friend would God have me be? And I know the answer to that because I know the sort of friendship that I want to be on the receiving end of. And working towards my ideals is something that is an ongoing piece of work. I can be of service. That helps me to move into other-centeredness. You know, for the last kind of 3 hours, I have barely thought about myself because I am doing something that is being of service. So it takes me out of self. I can be teachable and continue to expand my knowledge. I can ask for help. I can read with others. I can listen to podcasts. I can share on podcasts. You know, relatively recently, I thought that I was still struggling with the chapter We Agnostics, and I'd heard a fellow sharing about We Agnostics. It was on the other side of the world, and I just contacted him and said, "Can we just spend a bit of time? Will you just share with me what you hear in We Agnostics?" And it was absolutely amazing hearing his take on it, some of which I've shared with you tonight, because just having a different perspective on something is really, really helpful. I talked about the importance of self-care last week. That is another really important tool for me. And then growing into emotional sobriety, recognizing that I have an ism, not a wasm. I'm not done. Just because I've worked the steps does not mean to say I am done. My disease, the ism, the selfishness, the disease of self is still alive and well today. My feelings and emotions are still active, but I learn to recognize them, accept them, and move through them without affecting everyone around me adversely. I don't do that 100% of the time, but I am much more able to recognize what's going on with me. And, you know, I don't shout at the kids or whatever, that whatever I would have done previously. And I now have a framework for achieving physical sobriety, which is my plan of eating, exercise, and self-care. And just as I need a framework for achieving physical sobriety, I also need a framework for achieving emotional sobriety, which is my will being aligned with God. And that is the steps, prayer, meditation, increasing my knowledge, and focusing in on steps 10, 11, and 12. So some of the questions that were really helpful for me on step seven, and we've got time to do these questions, was what does humility mean to you? Do you see that low self-esteem as well as pride is evidence of lack of humility? Can you see that some of your character defects will not be removed immediately? And can you see the necessity of inviting God to remove shortcomings? And what's your experience around believing that God can remove your defects? So let's just take a couple of minutes just to have a think about that. Or you might just want to generally jot some bullet points down around your experience, strength, and hope around six and seven. That is also absolutely fine. So let's just take a couple of minutes just to consider those questions, or indeed your experience on step 6 and 7, and then we will round off hearing from you, sharing your experience, strength, and hope. Thank you.